Don't talk like that, my Arne, she begged, patting his arm. Kristen, said Arne in a muted voice, taking her in his arms again. Couldn't you consider asking your father? Lavrans is such a good man. He would never force you against your will. Couldn't you ask him to wait a few years? No one knows how my fortune may change. We're both so young. I must do what those at home want me to do, she sobbed. Then tears overcame Arne, too. You have no idea, Kristen, how much I love you. He hid his face on her shoulder. If you did, and if you loved me too, then you would go to Lavrans and beg him sweetly.
I can't do that, sobbed the maiden. I don't think I could ever love a man so dearly that I would go against my parents' will for his sake.
She slipped her hands under Arne's hood and heavy steel helmet to find his face.
You mustn't cry like that, Arne, my dearest friend.
I want you to have this, he said after a moment, giving her a small brooch. And think of me now and then, for I will never forget you or my sorrow. It was almost completely dark by the time Kristen and Arne had said their last farewells. She stood and gazed after him when he finally rode away. A yellow light shone through the clouds, and the light was reflected in their footsteps, where they had walked and stood in the slush of the road. It looked so cold and bleak, she thought. She pulled out the linen cloth covering her bodice and wiped her tear-streaked face. Then she turned around and set off for home. She was wet and cold, and she walked fast. After a while, she heard someone approaching on the road behind her. She was a little frightened. It was possible that strangers might be traveling on this main road, even on an evening like this, and she had a lonely stretch ahead of her. Steep black scree rose up on one side, but on the other there was a sharp drop-off covered with pine woods all the way down to the pale leaden river at the bottom of the valley. So she was relieved when the person behind her called her name. She stopped and waited. The person who approached was a tall, thin man wearing a dark surcoat with lighter colored sleeves. When he came closer, Kristen saw that he was dressed as a priest and carried an empty knapsack on his back. She now recognized Bentine Prestison, as they called him, Sira Eirik's grandson. She noticed at once that he was quite drunk.
Well, one departs and the other arrives, he said and laughed after they had greeted each other. I met Arne from Brecken just now, and I see that you're walking along and crying. So how about giving me a little smile because I've come back home? The two of us have also been friends since childhood, haven't we?
It's a poor bargain to have you come back to the valley in his stead, said Kristen crossly. She had never liked Bentine. Quite a few people will say the same, I'm afraid. And your grandfather was so happy that you were getting on so well down south in Oslo.
Oh, yes, said Bentine with a snicker and a sneer. So, you think I was getting on well, do you? Like a pig in a wheat field, that's how it was for me, Kristen. And the end result was the same. I was chased off with a shout and a long stick. Well, well. He doesn't have much joy from his offspring, my grandfather. Why are you walking so fast?
I'm freezing, said Kristen curtly.
No more than I am, said the priest. The only clothing I have to wear is what you see. I had to sell my cape for food and ale in Lillehammer. But you must still have warmth in your body from saying farewell to Arne. I think you should let me come under your furs with you.
And he seized hold of her cloak, threw it around his shoulders, and wrapped his wet arm around her waist. Kristen was so startled by his boldness that it took a moment for her to regain her senses. Then she tried to tear herself away, but he was holding onto her cloak, and it was fastened with a sturdy silver clasp. Bentine put his arms around her again and tried to kiss her, shoving his mouth close to her chin. She tried to strike him, but he was gripping her upper arms.
I think you've lost your mind, she seethed as she struggled against him. How dare you manhandle me as if I were a... You're going to regret this bitterly tomorrow, you miserable wretch.
Oh, tomorrow you won't be so stupid, said Bentine, tripping her with his leg so that she fell to her knees in the mud of the road. Then he pressed his hand over her mouth. And yet Kristen still did not think to scream. Now she finally realized what he intended to do to her, but rage overcame her with such fury and violence that she hardly felt any fear. She snarled like an animal in battle and fought against this man who was holding her down so that the ice-cold snow water soaked through her clothing and reached her burning hot flesh.
Tomorrow you'll know enough to keep quiet, said Bentine. And if it can't be concealed, you can always blame Arna. People will sooner believe that.
He had put a finger in her mouth, so she bit him with all her might, and Bentine screamed and loosened his grip. As quick as lightning, Kristen pulled one hand free and shoved it into his face, pressing her thumb as hard as she could into his eye. He bellowed and got up on one knee. She wriggled free like a cat, pushed the priest so that he fell onto his back, and then ran off down the road as the mud spurted up behind her with every step. She ran and ran without looking back. She heard Bentine coming after her, and she raced off with her heart pounding in her throat as she moaned softly and peered ahead. Would she never reach Lagerbru? At last, Kristen came to the part of the road where it passed through the fields. She saw buildings clustered on the hillside, and suddenly realized that she didn't dare go to her mother. Not the way she looked, covered with mud and withered leaves from head to toe, her clothing torn. She could feel Bentine coming closer. She bent down and picked up two big rocks, and when he was near enough, she threw them. One of them struck him so hard that it knocked him down. Then she started running again and didn't stop until she stood on the bridge. Trembling, she stood there holding on to the railing. Everything went black, and she was afraid that she would sink into unconsciousness. But then she thought about Bentine. What if he came and found her like that? Shaking with shame and bitterness, she kept on going, but her legs could hardly bear her, and now she felt how her face stung from the scratches of his fingernails, and she had hurt both her back and her arms. Tears came, hot as fire. She wished Bentine would be dead from the rock she had thrown. She wished she had gone back and put an end to him, that she had taken out her knife. But she noticed that she must have lost it. Then she realized again that she dared not be seen like this at home. It occurred to her that she could go to Romengard. She would complain to Sir Eirik. But the priest had not yet returned from Urengard. In the cookhouse she found Gunhild, Bentine's mother. The woman was alone, and then Kristen told her how her son had behaved toward her. But she didn't mention that she had gone out to meet Arna. When she realized that Gunhild thought she had been at Lagerbru, she didn't dissuade her. Gunhild said very little, but cried a great deal as she washed Kristen's clothing and mended the worst rips. And the young girl was so distressed that she didn't notice the glances Gunhild cast at her in secret. As Kristen was leaving, Gunhild put on her own cloak and followed her out the door, but then headed toward the stable. Kristen asked her where she was going.
"Surely I should be allowed to ride over and tend to my son," said the woman, "to see if you've killed him with that rock or what's happened to him."
Kristen had nothing to say in reply, so she simply told Gunhild to make sure that Bentine left the village as soon as possible. She never wanted to lay eyes on him again.
"Or I'll speak of this to Lavrans, and then you can well imagine what will happen."
Bentine headed south hardly more than a week later. He carried letters to the Bishop of Hamar from Sir Eirik, asking the bishop if he could find some occupation for Bentine or give him some assistance. Chapter 7. One day during the Christmas season, Simon Andersen arrived at Urengard on horseback, quite unexpected. He apologized for coming in this manner, uninvited and alone, without kinsmen,
but Sir Andres was in Sweden on business for the king. He himself had been at home at Diefrin for some time, but there he had only the company of his younger sisters and his mother, who was ill in bed, and the days had grown so dreary for him. He suddenly felt such an urge to come and see them. Ranfrid and Lavrans thanked him warmly for making the long journey at the height of winter. The more they saw of Simon, the more they liked him. He was well acquainted with everything that had been agreed upon between Andres and Lavrans, and it was now decided that the betrothal ale for the young couple would be celebrated before the beginning of Lent, if Sir Andres returned home before then, otherwise at Easter. Kristen was quiet and shy when she was with her betrothed. She found little to talk about with him. One evening, when everyone had been sitting and drinking, Simon asked her to go outside with him to get some fresh air. As they stood on the gallery in front of the loft room, he put his arm around her waist and kissed her. After that, he did it often whenever they were alone. She wasn't pleased by this, but she allowed him to do it because she knew there was no escape from the betrothal. Now she thought of her marriage as something she had to do, but not something that she looked forward to. And yet she liked Simon well enough, especially when he was talking to the others and did not touch her or speak to her. She had been so unhappy the entire autumn. It did no good to tell herself that Bentine had done her no harm. She felt herself defiled just the same. Nothing could be as it had been before, now that a man had dared to do such a thing to her. She lay awake at night, burning with shame, and she couldn't stop thinking about it. She remembered Bentine's body against hers when she fought with him, and his hot ale breath. She was forced to think about what might have happened, and she was reminded, as a shudder rippled through her flesh, of what he had said, that if it could not be concealed, then Arna would be blamed. Images raced through her head of everything that would have followed if she had ended up in such misfortune, and then people had found out about her meeting with Arna. And what if her mother and father had believed such a thing of Arna? And Arna himself? She saw him as he had looked on that last evening, and she felt as if she were sinking down before him in shame simply because she might have dragged him down along with her into sorrow and disgrace. And her dreams were so vile. She had heard about the desires and temptations of the flesh in church and in the Holy Scriptures, but it had meant nothing to her. Now it had become clear that she herself and everyone else had a sinful, fleshly body encompassing the soul, biting into it with harsh bands. Then she imagined how she might have killed Bentine or blinded him. That was the only consolation she could find, to indulge in dreams of revenge against that hideous dark figure who was always haunting her thoughts. But it never helped for long. She would lie next to Ulvil at night and weep about everything that had been visited upon her by violence. In her mind, Bentine had managed to breach her maidenhood all the same. On the first workday after the Christmas season, all the women of Urengard were busy in the cookhouse. Ranfrid and Kristen had also spent most of the day there. Late in the evening, while some of the women were cleaning up after the baking and others were preparing the evening meal, the milkmaid came rushing in, screaming as she threw up her hands.
"Jesus! Jesus! Has anyone ever heard more dreadful news? They're carrying Arna Geirdsson home in a sleigh! God help Geird and Inga in their misery!"
In came a man who lived in a house a short way down the road, and with him was Halldun. They were the ones who had met the funeral procession. The women crowded around them. On the very outskirts of the circle stood Kristen, pale and trembling. Halldun, Lavrin's own servant who had known Arna since he was a boy, sobbed loudly as he spoke. It was Bentine Prestison who had killed Arna. On New Year's Eve, the bishop's men were sitting in the men's house drinking when Bentine came in. He had become a scribe for a priest, a Corpus Christi prebendary. At first, the men didn't want to let Bentine in,
but he reminded Arna that they were from the same village. So Arna allowed him to sit with him, and they both began to drink. But then they came to blows, and Arna fought so fiercely that Bentine seized a knife from the table and stabbed Arna in the throat and then several times in the chest. Arna died almost at once. The bishop took this misfortune greatly to heart. He personally saw to it that the body was properly tended to, and he had his own men accompany it on the long journey home. He had Bentine thrown in irons and excommunicated from the church, and if he had not already been hanged, then he soon would be. Halfdan had to tell the story several times as more people crowded into the room. Lavrans and Simon also came over to the cookhouse when they noticed all the noise and commotion in the courtyard. Lavrans was much distressed. He ordered his horse to be saddled, for he wanted to ride over to Brecon at once. As he was about to leave, his eyes fell on Kristen's white face.
"Perhaps you would like to go with me?"
he asked. Kristen hesitated for a moment, shuddering, but then she nodded, for she didn't dare utter a word.
"Isn't it too cold for her?" said Ronfrid. "Tomorrow they will hold the wake, and then we'll all go."
Lavrans looked at his wife. He also glanced at Simon's face, and then he went over and put his arm around Kristen's shoulder.
"You must remember that she's his foster sister," he said. "Perhaps she would like to help Inga attend to the body."
And even though Kristen's heart was gripped with fear and despair, she felt a warm surge of gratitude toward her father for his words. Then Ronfrid wanted them to eat the evening porridge before they left, if Kristen would be going along. She also wanted to send gifts to Inga, a new linen sheet, candles, and freshly baked bread. She asked them to tell Inga that she would come to help them prepare for the burial. Little was eaten, but much was said in the room while the food stood on the table. One person reminded the other about the trials that God had visited upon Geird and Inga. Their farm had been destroyed by a rock slide and flood, and many of their older children had died, so all of Arna's siblings were still quite young. But fortune had been with them for several years now, ever since the bishop had appointed Geird of Finnsbrecken as his envoy, and the children they had been blessed to keep were good-looking and full of promise. But Inga had loved Arna more dearly than all the rest. People felt sorry for Sira Eirik, too. The priest was loved and respected, and the people in the village were proud of him. He was well-educated and capable, and in all his years with the church, he had not missed a single holy day or mass or service that he was obliged to observe. In his youth, he had been a soldier under Count Alv of Tornberg, but he had brought trouble on himself by killing a man of exceedingly high birth, and so he had turned to the Bishop of Oslo. When the bishop realized how quick Eirik was to acquire book learning, he had accepted him into the priesthood. And if not for the fact that he still had enemies because of that killing in the past, Sira Eirik would probably never have stayed at that little church. It's true that he was quite avaricious, both for his own purse and for his church. But the church was, after all, quite attractively furnished with vessels and draperies and books, and he did have those children. But he had never had anything but trouble and sorrow from his family. In the countryside, people thought it unreasonable to expect priests to live like monks, since they had to have women servants on their farms, and might well be in need of a woman to look after things for them, when they had to make such long and arduous journeys through the parish in all kinds of weather. People also remembered that it was not so long ago that priests in Norway had been married men. So no one blamed Sira Eirik for having three children by the housekeeper who was with him when he was young. On this evening, however, they said that it looked as if God wanted to punish Eirik for taking a mistress, since his children and grandchildren had caused him so much grief. And some people said that there was good reason for priests not to have wives or children, for enmity and indignation were bound to arise between the priest and the people of Finnsbrecken. Until now, they had been the best of friends. Simon Andresen was quite familiar with Bentine's conduct in Oslo, and he told the others about it. Bentine had become a scribe for the provost of the Maria Church and was considered a clever fellow. And there were plenty of women who were quite fond of him. He had those eyes and a quick tongue. Some thought him a handsome man, mostly women who felt they had been cheated by their husbands, or young maidens who enjoyed having men act freely toward them. Simon laughed. They knew what he meant, didn't they? Well, Bentine was so shrewd that he didn't get too close to those kinds of women. With them, he exchanged only words, and he won a reputation for leading a pure life. It so happened that King Haakon, who was a pious and decent man himself, wanted his men to maintain disciplined and proper behavior, at least the younger men. The others he had little control over. But the king's priest always heard about whatever pranks the young men managed to sneak out and take part in, drunken feasts, gambling, ale drinking, and the like. And then the rascals had to confess and repent, and they received harsh punishment. Yes, two or three of the wildest boys were even sent away. But at last it came to light that it was that fox, Bentine Secretarius, who had been secretly frequenting all of the alehouses and establishments that were even worse. He had actually listened to the confessions of horrors and had given them absolution. Kristen was sitting next to her mother. She tried to eat so that no one would notice how things stood with her, but her hand shook so badly that she spilled some of the porridge with every spoonful, and her tongue felt so thick and dry in her mouth that she could hardly swallow the bread. But when Simon began to talk about Bentine, she had to give up all pretense of eating. She gripped the edge of the bench with her hands. Terror and loathing took such a hold on her that she felt dizzy and filled with nausea. He was the one who had tried to... Bentine and Arna. Bentine and Arna. Sick with impatience, she waited for the others to finish. She longed to see Arna, Arna's handsome face, to fall to her knees and grieve, forgetting everything else. When Ronfrid helped Kristen into her outer garments, she kissed her daughter on the cheek. Kristen was unaccustomed to receiving any kind of caress from her mother, and it felt so good. She rested her head on Ronfrid's shoulder for a moment, but she could not cry. When she came out to the courtyard, she saw that there were more people coming with them, Halvdan, Jon of Laugarbru, and Simon and his servant. She felt unreasonably anguished that the two strangers would be going along. It was a biting cold night. The snow creaked underfoot, and the stars glittered as dense as frost in the black sky. After they had gone a short distance, they heard howls and shouts and furious hoofbeats south of the meadows. A little farther along the road, the whole pack of riders came storming up behind them and then raced on past. The sound of ringing metal and vapor from the steaming, frost-covered bodies of the horses rose up before Lavrans and his party as they moved out of the way into the snow. Halvdan shouted at the wild throng. It was the youths from the farm south of the village. They were still celebrating Christmas and were out trying their horses. Those who were too drunk to take notice raced on ahead, thundering and bellowing as they hammered on their shields. But a few of them understood the news that Halvdan had yelled after them. They dropped away from the group, fell silent, and joined Lavran's party as they whispered to the men in the back of the procession. They continued on until they could see Finnsbrekken on the slope alongside the Seal River. There was a light between the buildings. In the middle of the courtyard, the servants had set pine torches in a mound of snow, and the firelight gleamed red across the white hillock. But the dark houses looked as if they were streaked with clotted blood. One of Arna's little sisters was standing outside, stamping her feet, with her arms crossed under her cloak. Kristen kissed the tear-stained face of the freezing child. Her heart was as heavy as stone, and she felt as if there was lead in her limbs as she climbed the stairs to the loft where they had laid him out. The sound of hymns and the radiance of many lighted candles filled the doorway. In the center of the loft stood the coffin Arna had been brought home in, covered with a sheet. Boards had been placed over trestles, and the coffin had been lifted on top. At its head stood a young priest with a book in his hands, singing. All around him, people were kneeling with their faces hidden in their thick capes. Lavrans lit his candle from one of the candles in the room, set it firmly on the board of the bier, and knelt down. Kristen was about to do the same, but she couldn't get her candle to stand. Then Simon stepped over to help her. As long as the priest prayed, everyone remained on their knees, repeating his words in a whisper, so that the steam hovered around their mouths. It was ice cold in the loft. When the priest closed his book, the people rose. Many had already gathered in the death chamber. Lavrans went over to Inga. She was staring at Kristen and seemed not to hear Lavrans' words. She stood there with the gifts he had given her, holding them as if unaware that she had anything in her hands.
So you have come too, Kristen, she said in an odd, strained tone of voice. Perhaps you would like to see my son? The way he has come back to me?
She moved a few candles aside, grabbed Kristen's arm with a trembling hand, and with the other, she tore the cloth from the dead man's face. It was grayish-yellow like mud, and his lips were the color of lead. They were slightly parted so that the even, narrow, bone-white teeth seemed to offer a mocking smile. Beneath the long eyelashes could be seen a glimpse of his glazed eyes, and there were several bluish-black spots high on his cheeks that were either bruises from the fight or the marks of a corpse.
Perhaps you would like to kiss him?
Asked Inga in the same tone of voice, and Kristen obediently leaned forward and pressed her lips to the dead man's cheek. It was clammy, as if from dew, and she thought she could faintly smell the stench of the corpse. He had no doubt begun to thaw out in the heat from all the candles. Kristen remained leaning there, with her hands on the bier, for she did not have the strength to stand up. Inga pulled aside more of the shroud, so the gash from the knife wound across his collarbone was visible. Then she turned to the people and said in a quavering voice,
I see that it's a lie, what people say. That a dead man's wounds will bleed if he's touched by the one who caused his death? He's colder now, my boy, and not as handsome as when you last met him down on the road. You don't care to kiss him now, I see, but I've heard that you didn't refuse his lips back then.
Inga, said Lavrans, stepping forward, have you lost your senses? What are you saying?
Oh, you're all so grand over there at Urengard. You are much too rich a man, Lavrans Björgulfsson, for my son to dare court your daughter with honor. And no doubt Kristen thought she was too good for him, too. But she wasn't too good to run after him on the road at night and dally with him in the thickets on the evening he left. Ask her yourself, and we'll see if she dares to deny it. As Arna lies here dead, she who has brought this upon us with her loose ways.
Lavrans did not ask the question. Instead, he turned to Gerd.
You must rein in your wife. She has taken leave of her senses.
But Kristen raised her pale face and looked around in despair.
I did go out to meet Arna on that last evening because he asked me to do so. But nothing happened between us that was not proper.
And as she seemed to pull herself together and fully realize what was implied, she shouted loudly,
I don't know what you mean, Inga. Are you defaming Arna as he lies here? Never did he try to entice or seduce me.
But Inga laughed loudly.
Arna? No, not Arna. But Bentine didn't let you play with him that way. Ask Gunhild, Lavrans, who washed the filth off your daughter's back, and ask any man who was in the men's quarters at the Bishop's Citadel on New Year's Eve, when Bentine ridiculed Arna for having let her go, and then was made her fool. She let Bentine come under her fur as she walked home, and she tried to play the same game with him.
Lavrans gripped Inga by the shoulder and pressed his hand against her mouth.
Get her out of here, Gerd. It's shameful that you should talk this way before the body of this good boy. But even if all of your children lay here dead, I would not stand and listen to your lies about mine. And you, Gerd, will have to answer for what this demented woman is saying.
Geard took hold of his wife to lead her away, but he said to Lavrans,
It's true that Arna and Bentine were talking about Kristen when my son lost his life. It's understandable that you may not have heard it, but there has been talk here in the village this fall.
Simon slammed his sword into the nearest clothes chest.
No, good folks.
Now you will have to find something other than my betrothed to talk about in this death chamber. Priest, can't you harness these people so that everything proceeds according to custom?
The priest. Kristen now saw that he was the youngest son from Ulveswold, who had been home for Christmas, opened his book and took up his position next to the bier. But Lavrans shouted that those who had spoken of his daughter, whoever they might be, would have to eat their words. And then Inga screamed,
Go ahead and take my life, Lavrans, just as she has taken all my solace and joy, and celebrate her marriage to this son of a knight. And yet everyone will know that she was married to Bentine on the road. Here!
And she threw the sheet that Lavrans had given her across the bier to Kristen.
I don't need Ronfrid's linen to wrap around Arna for burial. Make yourself a kerchief out of it, or keep it to swaddle your wayside, bastard. And go over to help Gunnhild mourn for the hanged man.
Lavrans, Geard, and the priest all seized hold of Inga. Simon tried to lift up Kristen, who was lying across the bier, but she vehemently shook off his hand, and then, still on her knees, she straightened up and shouted loudly,
May God my savior help me! That is a lie!
She put out her hand and held it over the nearest candle on the bier. It looked as if the flame wavered and moved aside. Kristen felt everyone's eyes upon her, for a very long time it seemed. Then she suddenly noticed a searing pain in her palm, and with a piercing shriek, she collapsed onto the floor. She thought she had fainted, but she could feel Simon and the priest lifting her up. Inga screamed something. She saw her father's horrified face and heard the priest shout that no one should consider it a true trial. This was not the way to ask God to bear witness. And then Simon carried Kristen out of the loft and down the stairs. Simon's servant ran to the stable, and a moment later Kristen, still only half-conscious, was sitting on the front of Simon's saddle, wrapped in his cape, as he rode down toward the village as fast as his horse could carry them. They had almost reached Urengard when Lavrans overtook them. The rest of their entourage came thundering along the road far behind.
Say nothing to your mother, said Simon as he set Kristen down next to the door. We've heard far too much senseless talk tonight. It's no wonder that you fainted in the end.
Ronfrid was lying awake when they came in, and she asked how things had gone at the vigil. Simon spoke for all of them. Yes, there were many candles and many people. Yes, a priest was there, Tormod of Ulveswold. Of Sira Eirik, she heard that he had ridden south to Hamar that very evening, so they would avoid any difficulty at the burial.
We must have a mass said for the boy, said Ronfrid. May God give Inga strength. She has been sorely tried, that good, capable woman.
Lavrans fell in with the tone that Simon had set, and in a little while Simon said that now they must all go to bed, for Kristen is both tired and sad. Sometime later, when Ronfrid had fallen asleep, Lavrans threw on some clothes and went over to sit on the edge of the bed where his daughters were sleeping. In the dark he found Kristen's hand, and then he said gently,
Now you must tell me, child, what is true and what is a lie in all this talk that Inga is spouting.
Sobbing, Kristen told him of everything that had happened on the evening that Arna left for Hamar. Lavrans said little. Then Kristen crawled forward on the bed and threw her arms around his neck, whimpering softly.
I am to blame for Arna's death. It's true what Inga said.
Arna himself asked you to come and meet him, said Lavrans, pulling the covers up around his daughter's bare shoulders. It was thoughtless of me to allow the two of you to spend so much time together, but I thought the boy had better sense. I won't blame the two of you. I can see that these things are heavy for you to bear. And yet I never imagined that any of my daughters would fall into ill repute here in our village. It will be painful for your mother when she hears this news. But you went to Gunhild instead of coming to me. That was so unwise that I can't understand how you could act so foolishly.
I don't want to stay here in the village any longer, wept Kristen. I don't dare look a single person in the eye. And all the sorrow I have caused those at Romengard and at Finsbrecken.
Yes, said Lavrans. They will have to make sure, both Geird and Sira Eirik, that these lies about you are put in the ground along with Arna. Otherwise, it is Simon Andersen who can best defend you in this matter.
And he patted her in the dark.
Don't you think he handled things well and with good sense?
Father,
Kristen begged, fearful and fervent, as she clung to him.
Send me to the cloister, Father. Yes, listen to me. I've thought about this for a long time. Maybe Ulvil will get well if I go in her place. Do you remember the shoes that I sewed for her this autumn? The ones with pearls on them? I pricked my fingers so badly, I bled from the sharp gold thread. I sat and sewed those shoes because I thought it was wrong that I didn't love my sister enough to become a nun and help her. Arna asked me about that once. If I had said yes back then, none of this would have happened.
Lavrans shook his head.
Lie down now, he told her. You don't know what you're saying, my poor child. Now you must try to sleep.
But Kristen lay there, feeling the pain in her burned hand. Bitterness and despair over her fate raged in her heart. Things could not have gone worse for her if she had been the most sinful of women. Everyone would believe. No, she couldn't. She couldn't stand to stay here in the village. Horror after horror appeared before her. When her mother found out about this. And now there was blood between them and their parish priest. Hostility among all those around her who had been friends her whole life. But the most extreme and oppressive fears seized her whenever she thought of Simon. The way he had picked her up and carried her off and spoken for her at home and acted as if she were his property. Her father and mother had yielded to him as if she already belonged more to him than to them. Then she remembered Arna's face, cold and hideous. She remembered that she had seen an open grave waiting for a body the last time she came out of church. The chopped-up lumps of earth lay on the snow, hard and cold and gray as iron. That was where she had brought Arna. Suddenly she thought about a summer night many years before. She was standing on the loft gallery at Finsbrecken, the same loft where she had been struck down this evening. Arna was playing ball with some boys down in the courtyard, and the ball came sailing up to her on the gallery. She held it behind her back and refused to give it up when Arna came to retrieve it. Then he tried to take it from her by force, and they had fought over it on the gallery, then inside the loft among the chests. The leather sacks full of clothes that were hanging there knocked them on the head when they ran into them during the chase. They had fought and tumbled over that ball. And now she finally seemed to realize that he was dead and gone, and that she would never see his brave, handsome face or feel his warm hands again. She had been so childish and heartless that it had never occurred to her how he would feel about losing her. She wept in despair and thought she deserved her own unhappiness. But then she started thinking again about everything that still awaited her, and she wept because she thought the punishment that would befall her was too severe. Simon was the one who told Ronfrid about what had happened at the vigil at Brecken the night before. He made no more of the matter than was necessary. But Kristen was so dazed from grief and a sleepless night that she felt a purely unreasonable bitterness toward him, because he could speak of it as if it were not so terrible after all. She also felt a great displeasure at the way her parents let Simon act as if he were the master of the house.
"So you don't think anything of it, Simon?" asked Ronfrid anxiously.
"No," replied Simon, "and I don't think anyone else will either. They know you and her, and they know this Bentine. But there's not much to talk about in this remote village. It's perfectly reasonable for people to help themselves to this juicy tidbit,
Now we'll have to teach them that Kristen's reputation is too rich a diet for the peasants around here. But it's too bad that she was so frightened by his coarseness that she didn't come to you at once, or go to Sira Irik himself. I think that whorehouse priest would have gladly testified that he had meant no more than some innocent teasing if you had spoken to him, Lavrans. Both parents agreed that Simon was right. But Kristen gave a shriek and stamped her foot.
But he knocked me to the ground. I hardly know what he did to me. I was out of my senses. I no longer remember a thing. For all I know, it might be as Inga says. I haven't been well or happy for a single day since.
Ronfrid gave a cry and pressed her hands together. Lavrans leaped to his feet. Even Simon's face changed expression. He gave Kristen a sharp look, went over to her, and put his hand under her chin. Then he laughed.
God bless you, Kristen. You would have remembered it if he had done you any harm. It's no wonder she's been feeling melancholy and unwell since that unlucky evening when she was given such a fright. She who has never met with anything but kindness and goodwill before, he said to the others. Anyone can see from her eyes, which bear no ill intent and would rather believe in good than evil, that she is a maiden and not a woman.
Kristen looked up into the small, steady eyes of her betrothed. She raised her arms halfway up. She wanted to place them around his neck. Then Simon went on.
You mustn't think, Kristen, that you won't forget all about this.
I don't intend for us to settle at Formo right away and never allow you to leave this valley. No one has the same color of hair or temperament in the rain as in the sun, said old King Svira when they accused his birch-leg followers of growing arrogant with success. Lavrans and Ronfrid smiled. It amused them to hear the young man speak as if he were a wise old bishop. Simon continued,
It would not be proper for me to admonish you, the man who is to be my father-in-law, but perhaps I might say this much. We were dealt with more strictly, my siblings and I. We were not allowed to move so freely among the servants as I see it is Kristen's custom. My mother used to say that if you play with the cottager's children, in the long run you'll end up with lice in your hair. And there is some truth to that.
Lavrans and Ronfrid said nothing to this. But Kristen turned away, and the desire she had felt for a moment to put her arms around Simon Dare's neck had vanished completely. Around midday, Lavrans and Simon put on their skis and went off to tend to several traps up on the ridge. Outdoors, it was now beautiful weather, sunny and not nearly as bitter cold. Both men were relieved to slip away from all the sorrow and tears at home, so they skied a great distance, all the way up to the bare rock. They lay in the sun under a steep cliff and drank and ate. Then Lavrans talked a little about Arna. He had been very fond of the boy. Simon joined in, praising the dead man, and said that he didn't find it strange that Kristen should grieve for her foster brother. Then Lavrans mentioned that perhaps they should not pressure her so much, but give her a little more time to regain her composure before they celebrated the betrothal ale. She had said that she would like to go to a cloister for a while. Simon sat up suddenly and gave a long whistle.
You don't care for the idea? Asked Lavrans.
Oh, yes, yes, replied the other man hastily.
This seems to be the best counsel, dear father-in-law. Send her to the sisters in Oslo for a year. Then she'll learn how people talk about each other out in the world. I happen to know a little about several of the maidens who are there, he said and laughed. They wouldn't lie down and die of grief over two mad boys tearing each other apart for their sake. Not that I want such a maiden for my wife, but I don't think it would do Kristen any harm to meet some new people.
Lavrans put the rest of the food in the knapsack and said, without looking at the young man,
You are fond of Kristen, I think.
Simon laughed a little but did not look at Lavrans.
You must know that I have great affection for her. And for you as well, Simon said brusquely, and then he stood up and put on his skis. I have never met any maiden I would rather marry.
Right before Easter, while it was still possible to drive a sleigh down the valley and across Lake Mirsa, Kristen made her second journey to the south. Simon came to escort her to the cloister. So this time she traveled with her father and her betrothed, sitting in the sleigh, wrapped in furs. And accompanying them were servants and sleighs full of her chests of clothing, and gifts of food and furs for the abbess, and the sisters of Nonnesetter. Part 2. The Wreath. Chapter 1. Early one Sunday morning at the end of April, Osmund Bjørgulfsson's church boat glided past the point on the island of Hovedo. As the bells rang in the cloister church, and bells from the town chimed their reply out across the bay, sounding louder, then fainter, as the wind carried the notes. The sky was clear and pale blue, with light fluted clouds drifting across it, and the sun was glinting restlessly on the rippling water. It seemed quite spring-like along the shore. The fields were almost bare of snow, and there were bluish shadows and a yellowish sheen on the leafy thickets. But snow was visible in the spruce forest atop the ridges framing the settlements of Aker, and to the west, on the distant blue mountains beyond the fjord, many streaks of white still gleamed. Kristen was standing in the bow of the boat with her father and Hiri, Osmund's wife. She turned her gaze toward the town, with all of its light-colored churches and stone buildings rising up above the multitudes of grayish-brown wooden houses and the bare crowns of the trees. The wind ruffled the edges of her cloak and tousled her hair beneath her hood. They had let the livestock out to pasture at Skog the day before, and Kristen had suddenly felt such a homesickness for Urengard. It would be a long time before they could let out the cattle back home. She felt a tender and sympathetic longing for the winter-gaunt cattle in the dark stalls. They would have to wait and endure for many days yet. She missed everyone so, her mother, Ulvil, who had slept in her arms every night for all these years, little Romborg. She longed for all the people back home and for the horses and dogs, for Cortalyn, whom Ulvil would take care of while she was gone, and for her father's hawks, sitting on their perches with hoods over their heads. Next to them hung the gloves made of horsehide, which had to be worn when handling them, and the ivory sticks used to scratch them. All the terrible events of the winter now seemed so far away, and she only remembered her home as it had been before. They had also told her that no one in the village thought ill of her. Nor did Sira Eirik. He was angry and aggrieved by what Bentine had done. Bentine had escaped from Hamar, and it was said that he had run off to Sweden. So things had not been as unpleasant between her family and the people of the neighboring farm as Kristen had feared. On their way south, they had stayed at Simon's house, and she had met his mother and siblings. Sir Andres was still in Sweden. She had not felt at ease there, and her dislike of the family at Dyfrin was all the greater because she knew of no reasonable explanation for it. During the entire journey, she had told herself that they had no reason to be haughty or to consider themselves better than her ancestors. No one had ever heard of Rider Dara, the birch leg, until King Svira found the widow of the baron at Dyfrin for him to wed. But they turned out not to be haughty at all, and Simon even spoke of his ancestor one evening. "I have now found out for certain that he was supposed to have been a comb maker. So you will truly be joining a royal lineage, Kristen," he said. "Guard your tongue, my boy," said his mother, but they all laughed. Kristen felt so oddly distressed when she thought of her father. He laughed a great deal whenever Simon gave him the least reason to do so. The thought occurred to her that perhaps her father would have liked to laugh more often in his life, but she didn't like it that he was so fond of Simon. During Easter, they were all at Skog. Kristen noticed that her uncle Osmund was a stern master toward his tenants and servants. She met a few people who asked after her mother and who spoke affectionately of Lavrans. They had enjoyed better days when he was living there. Osmund's mother, who was Lavrans' stepmother, lived on the farm in her own house. She was not particularly old, but she was sickly and feeble. Lavron seldom spoke of her at home. Once, when Kristen asked her father whether he had had a quarrelsome stepmother, he had replied,
"She has never done much for me, good or bad."
Kristen reached for her father's hand, and he squeezed hers in return.
"I know you'll be happy with the worthy sisters, my daughter. There you'll have other things to think about than yearning for us back home."
They sailed so close to the town that the smell of tar and salt fish drifted out to them from the docks. Kiri pointed out the churches and farms and roads that stretched upward from the water's edge. Kristen recognized nothing from the last time she had been there except for the ponderous towers of Hallvard's Cathedral. They sailed west, around the entire town, and then put in at the nun's dock. Kristen walked between her father and her uncle past a cluster of warehouses and then reached the road, which led uphill past the fields. Hirid followed after them, escorted by Simon. The servants stayed behind to help several men from the cloister load the trunks onto a cart. The convent Nonneseter and all of Lyran lay inside the town's boundaries, but there were only a few houses clustered here and there along the road. The larks were chirping overhead in the pale blue sky, and tiny yellow Michaelmas daisies teemed on the sallow dirt hills. But along the fences, the roots of the grass were green. As they went through the gate and entered the colonnade, all the nuns came walking toward them in a procession from church, with music and song streaming after them from the open doorway. Kristen stared uneasily at the many black-clad women with white wimples framing their faces. She sank into a curtsy, and the men bowed with their hats pressed to their chests. Following the nuns came a group of young maidens. Some of them were children, wearing dresses of undyed homespun, with black and white belts made of twisted cord around their waists. Their hair was pulled back from their faces and braided tightly, with the same kind of black and white cord. Kristen unconsciously put on a haughty expression for the young maidens, because she felt shy, and she was afraid that they would think she looked unrefined and foolish. The convent was so magnificent that she was completely overwhelmed. All the buildings surrounding the inner courtyard were made of gray stone. On the north side, the long wall of the church loomed above the other buildings. It had a two-tiered roof and a tower at the west end. The surface of the courtyard was paved with flagstones, and the entire area was enclosed by a covered arcade supported by stately pillars. In the center of the square stood a stone statue of Mater Misericordiae, spreading her cloak over a group of kneeling people. A lay sister came forward and asked them to follow her to the parlatory, the abbess's reception room. Abbess Groa Guttorm's daughter was a tall, stout old woman. She would have been good-looking if she hadn't had so many stubbly hairs around her mouth. Her voice was deep and made her sound like a man. But she had a pleasant manner, and she reminded Lavrans that she had known his parents, and then asked after his wife and their other children. At last, she turned kindly to Kristen.
"I have heard good things of you, and you seem to be clever and well brought up, so I do not think you will give us any reason for displeasure."
"I have heard that you are promised to that noble and good man, Simon Anderson, whom I see before me."
"We think it wise of your father and your betrothed to send you here to the Virgin Mary's house for a time, so that you can learn to obey and to serve before you are charged with giving orders and commands. I want to impress on you now that you should learn to find joy in prayer and the divine services, so that in all your actions you will be in the habit of remembering your Creator, the Lord's gentle mother, and all the saints who have given us the best examples of strength, rectitude, fidelity, and all the virtues that you ought to demonstrate if you are to manage property and servants and raise children. You will also learn in this house that one must pay close attention to time, because here each hour has a specific purpose and chore. Many young maidens and wives are much too fond of lying in bed late in the morning and of lingering at the table in the evening,
carrying on useless conversation. But you do not look as if you were that kind. Yet you can learn a great deal from this year that will benefit you both here and in that other home. Kristen curtsied and kissed her hand. Then Fru Groa told Kristen to follow an exceptionally fat old nun, whom she called Sister Potencia, over to the nun's refectory. She invited the men and Fru Heary to dine with her in a different room. The refectory was a beautiful hall. It had a stone floor and arched windows with glass panes. A doorway led into another room, and Kristen could see that this room too must have glass window panes, because the sun was shining inside. The sisters had already sat down and were waiting for the food. The older nuns were sitting on a stone bench covered with cushions along the wall under the windows. The younger sisters and the bare-headed maidens wearing light homespun dresses sat on a wooden bench in front of the table. Tables had also been set in the adjoining room, which was intended for the most distinguished of the Corodians and the lay servants. There were several old men among them. These people did not wear cloister garb, but they did wear dark and dignified attire. Sister Potencia showed Kristen to a place on the outer bench while she herself went over to a seat near the abbess's place of honor at the head of the table, which would remain empty today. Everyone rose, both in the main hall and in the adjoining room, as the sisters said the blessing. Then a young, pretty nun came forward and stepped up to a lectern, which had been placed in the doorway between the rooms. And while two of the lay sisters in the main hall and two of the youngest nuns in the other room brought in the food and drink, the nun read in a loud and lovely voice, without pausing or hesitating at a single word, the story of Saint Theodora and Saint Didymus. From the very first moment, Kristen thought most about showing good table manners, for she noticed that all the sisters and young maidens had such elegant comportment and ate so properly, as if they were at the most magnificent banquet. There was an abundance of the best food and drink, but everyone took only modest portions, using only the tips of their fingers to help themselves from the platters. No one spilled any soup on the tablecloth or on their clothes, and everyone cut up the meat into such tiny pieces that they hardly sullied their lips. They ate so carefully that not a sound could be heard. Kristen was sweating with fear that she wouldn't be able to act as refined as the others. She also felt uncomfortable in her brightly colored attire among all the women dressed in black and white. She imagined that they were all staring at her. Then, as she was about to eat a piece of fatty mutton breast and was holding it with two fingers pressed against the bone, while in her right hand she held the knife, trying to cut easily and neatly, the whole thing slipped away from her. The bread and the meat leaped onto the tablecloth as the knife fell with a clatter to the floor. The sound was deafening in that quiet room. Kristen blushed red as blood and was about to bend down to pick up the knife, but a lay sister wearing sandals came over, soundlessly, and gathered up the things. But Kristen could eat nothing more. She also noticed that she had cut her finger, and she was afraid of bleeding on the tablecloth, so she sat there with her hand wrapped up in a fold of her dress, thinking that now she was making spots on the lovely light blue gown that she had been given for her journey to Oslo, and she didn't dare raise her eyes from her lap. After a while, she started to listen more closely to what the nun was reading. When the chieftain could not sway the maiden Theodora's steadfast will, she would neither make sacrifices to false gods nor let herself be married, he ordered her to be taken to a brothel. Furthermore, he exhorted her along the way to think of her freeborn ancestors and her honorable parents, upon whom an everlasting shame would now fall, and he promised that she would be allowed to live in peace and remain a maiden if she would agree to serve a pagan goddess, whom they called Diana. Theodora replied, unafraid, "Chastity is like a lamp, but love for God is the flame. If I were to serve the devil woman whom you call Diana, then my chastity would be worth no more than a rusty lamp without fire or oil. You call me freeborn, but we are all born thralls since our first parents sold us to the devil. Christ has redeemed me, and I am obliged to serve him, so I cannot marry his enemies. He will protect his dove, but if he would cause you to break my body, which is the temple